I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. 3 years after he was arrested for leaking hundreds of thousands of pages of classified military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks and several news organizations, Bradley Manning was found guilty this week of 20 charges, including espionage. He was acquitted of the most serious charge, aiding the enemy. The judge is hearing from witnesses now and will decide on sentencing in the next few weeks. Earlier this year, Bradley Manning admitted to sending information to WikiLeaks and pled guilty to a number of charges. His case generated a great deal of attention and controversy, in part because of his treatment in military prison. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. And we begin with Michael Doyle. He's legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers based in Washington, D.C., has been covering the Bradley Manning case for McClatchy. And Mike Doyle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be with you.
The headline from every newspaper, including yours, was that Bradley Manning was acquitted of the most serious charge. This was aiding the enemy. What was the prosecution trying to argue by charging him with this crime?
It was a very aggressive charge, which is why it drew the most attention. The prosecution's theory was that by providing 700,000 documents to WikiLeaks, Manning was indirectly providing information to Al-Qaeda and other enemies of the United States. Under the aiding the enemy statute, you can be convicted not only for directly aiding the enemy, going to an alley and handing Osama bin Laden the files, but also indirectly aiding them. And the theory of the government was by making available for publication secret documents, Manning was thereby assisting Al-Qaeda. It was not an argument that the judge accepted.
Did she say anything more besides not guilty or acquitted?
No, there was no written explanation for the verdicts, and in the relatively brief verdict portion of the trial, all Colonel Denise Lynn did was announce not guilty or guilty, and gave no explanation for her reasons.
Could he have gotten the death penalty if she had found him guilty of this?
In theory, yes. In practice, no. The aiding the enemy charge is a capital offense, and the prosecution had in its arsenal the possibility of seeking the death penalty, but they had ruled that out from the start. So the sentence that Bradley Manning faced, had he been found guilty on that charge, would have been life in prison without possibility of parole. Now, having been found guilty of or pled guilty to 20 other charges, right now Manning faces up to 136 years in prison, and although I would say it's unlikely, he could spend the rest of his life even now in prison.
Can we tease apart some of these charges? A number of charges of espionage. What did the court find?
He was found guilty on six specifications relating to espionage, which deal with specific pieces of information that were made available to WikiLeaks. And these involved, for instance, information on a particular contingency operations or on the particular databases of concerning the Iraq or Afghanistan war. In addition, Manning was found guilty of theft of government property and disobeying orders with regard to information security.
And the judge is now, what, hearing from witnesses and will decide on sentencing?
That's right. Starting yesterday, Judge Lind in the courtroom at Fort Meade, Maryland, began hearing initially from prosecution witnesses. These are current or former officers involved with assessing the damage from the leaks of information. And what the government's, that is the prosecution's task, is to show that the Manning leaks were immensely harmful to the United States. And during the cross-examination of these witnesses, the defense counsel, David Coombs, representing Manning, are trying to say, the damage was not that great. Following the prosecution witnesses, and they resumed the sentencing portion of the trial just a few minutes ago, Mr. Coombs, as the defense attorney, will put on his own witnesses, who will speak to Manning's character and the virtuous motivations he had for releasing the documents.
Is this evidence and testimony that was not allowed in the trial that is allowed in the sentencing part of this case?
Yeah, that's certainly the case, particularly with regard to Manning's character. David Coombs, during his closing and opening statements at trial, spoke of Manning's character, his personality, his intentions, his shock at some of the things that he saw in the databases and on video, and he'll be able. The defense will flesh those notions out as to character and motivation during the sentencing portion. The defense was very strictly limited in talking about motivation during the trial itself. The government will be presenting some closed or testimony behind closed doors from witnesses who will speak in greater specificity about the alleged harm that was caused by the document's release.
And what has Manning said? He has spoken before, but what has he said to explain why he released all this information?
Manning is for the moment speaking, of course, through his defense attorney, David Coombs, and the way Mr. Coombs characterizes Manning's release, this was a 21-year-old, perhaps relatively naive, innocent in the ways of the world, and idealistic young man who, when he was assigned to forward operating base Hammer in Iraq in 2009, was confronted with the hard facts of the world, that people were dying, civilians often, that the U.S. foreign policy was driven by realpolitik, that there were deception was being practiced. And according to Mr. Coombs' characterization, Manning was shocked by what he saw. He was particularly, according to Mr. Coombs, struck by a video showing an Apache helicopter attack that killed 11 Iraqis, including several journalists. And according to Coombs' characterization, Manning was shocked into taking pretty dramatic action in order to bring to public light what he had learned about U.S. foreign and military policy.
But what's curious about this case is that Bradley Manning had actually pled guilty to a number of charges. This was back in February.
Well, that's right. And those charges that he agreed to plead guilty to by themselves could have brought him 20 years in prison, probably at the U.S. disciplinary barracks in Leavenworth, Kansas. And there was a school of thought that the government, that is the prosecution, was going to unnecessary lengths to charge him with the Espionage Act violations, additional violations, and certainly the most aggressive charge of aiding the enemy. This whole trial, which lasted 2 months, the expense of it and so on, could have been short-circuited had the government simply accepted Manning's guilty plea. But for their own reasons, perhaps to send a signal and perhaps out of outrage over what they believe Manning did, the government did pile on additional charges, and now instead of facing 20 years in prison, Manning faces 136.
Now, he was arrested. This was back in May 2010. And his case got a fair amount of attention and some controversy even on the way that he was or how he was treated when he was held in the brig. Can you speak to that at all? What do we know about those conditions and how he was treated?
Manning is in the United States Army, but for reasons of their own, the military confined him initially at the Quantico Marine Corps base in the brig. And Manning was held under very severe conditions. The Marine Corps said he was on suicide watch, which meant that the lights were kept on in the cell up to 24 hours a day. He was at times stripped naked, ostensibly to prevent him from trying to harm himself. He was under constant scrutiny. By any measure, there were harsh standards. The Marine Corps said it was necessary to protect him from himself. Eventually, Manning was taken back into custody by the Army. And Judge Lind, in a very interesting decision, said that whatever sentence she levies against Manning will be offset by some hundred or so days that he had served in additional days for the treatment that he received at Quantico. So when the sentence comes down, which may be in several weeks, whatever the sentence is will be offset by approximately 3 years that Manning has served awaiting trial. In addition, there will be some additional days off for the treatment that he received at Quantico.
Do you think the judge was saying that he was mistreated?
So inappropriately treated. Mistreatment, I think, would go too far. But the judge Lind, in a ruling on that defense motion, agreed that the treatment was disproportionate or unnecessary, and deserve to be taken into account with the final sentencing.
Was this an unusual trial to cover as a journalist?
It was in several respects. First was its location at Fort Meade. Fort Meade is north of Washington, D.C. It's the home to the super secret National Security Agency. As a military facility, it's hard to get onto. The courtroom itself, of course, there was no television cameras allowed. Only eight reporters typically were allowed in the courtroom. The rest were sequestered in a media facility that was some remove. At certain points during the trial, military police officers would be peering over the shoulders of reporters and scrutinizing what they were doing. Those reporters in the courtroom were prohibited from tweeting accounts. And it was unusual in how reporters adapted. There was a privately funded stenographer who was, through the Freedom of the Press Foundation, providing a daily informal but complete transcript of the accounts. And frankly, that's how I did a lot of my own reporting, is to read the transcripts at the end of the day, because getting to the base was so difficult.
I also read that at one point a sketch artist was banned from the courtroom. Did I read that right?
You read that right. Now, this was a sketch artist, not in the formal courtroom sense, but this was an individual who was doing sketches of the trial, and it came to the judge's attention that the artist had bumper stickers on the vehicle that suggested support for Manning. Mm-hmm. That, and perhaps for other reasons that we don't fully know, caused Judge Lynn to ban that sketch artist slash Manning supporter from the courtroom. Like a number of other decisions in this trial, it's not entirely easy to find out exactly what happened and why. The judge did explain to the defense and the prosecution what she was doing, and there was no objection to it.
And we're almost out of time here, but did Bradley Manning, he chose a judge, not a jury, for his trial, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. He had the option, as military defendants do, of either being tried by a panel of six or more members of the military, either enlisted and or enlisted and officers, or to be trialed by judge alone. The defense, and I would guess in this case it was the very experienced defense attorney David Coombe who was the guiding force behind it, the defense made the determination that Manning would do better by being trialed before a judge. And I can't reach into the mind of the defense attorney too much, but that may have been a tactical consideration that a judge would be more likely to be sympathetic to a degree to Manning than a jury of his military peers.
Well, Michael Doyle, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
My pleasure.
And he's legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, has been covering the Bradley Manning case and trial for McClatchy. We have two guests waiting in the wings. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about the Bradley Manning verdict, trial, and case. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, the Brooklyn-based ensemble Kavkaz and the New Jersey Opera Project present the music of Azerbaijan, Russia, and Persia. Azari and Persian folk songs are accompanied by traditional Azari instruments, and classically trained singers perform arias in this rarely presented repertoire. Art After Five, beginning at 5:45. More details available at philamuseum.org.
Camden, New Jersey, a test city for the Affordable Care Act. Why? Well, there's this.
I could stick someone in a limo, drive them around the city, hire a personal doctor, bring their pills to them every day for less than what we're spending right now on hospitalization.
I'm Kai Rizdal, a new series, Healthcare in One City Over 1 Year, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, how can the richest country on earth rank 12th in the world when it comes to college completion? We'll ask the Education Secretary, Arne Duncan.
We have to stop being so complacent, and I would argue we have to get better at every level from cradle to career.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Army Private Bradley Manning was arrested in the spring of 2010 after he released 700,000 pages of military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks and a number of news organizations charged with leaking classified information. This week, he was found guilty of multiple charges of espionage, theft, and other crimes. He was found not guilty of the most serious charge against him, aiding the enemy. We're talking about the case against Bradley Manning, the trial, the verdict, what all this says about leaks, secrets, and classified information. Joining us by telephone is P.J. Crowley, served as Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs and State Department spokesman under Hillary Clinton, resigned from his post after criticizing the Pentagon's treatment of Bradley Manning. And P.J. Crowley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
A pleasure, Marty.
Also with us is Ben Weisner. He's director of the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project, dedicated to protecting and expanding First Amendment freedoms of expression, association, and inquiry. And Ben Weisner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Ben, let me begin with you. And PJ, I'd like to hear from you as well. And we'll start with the most serious charge against Bradley Manning, this charge of aiding the enemy. The judge said not guilty on this particular charge, acquitted of this charge. Was that the right thing to do, Ben?
Well, I think it was certainly the right thing to do. The even righter thing to do would have been for her to dismiss that charge before trial because acquitting Manning means that she rejected the government's evidence, but not the government's legal theory. The government's legal theory is that any time anyone who is subject to military jurisdiction, anyone in the Army or the Armed Forces, shares any information that ends up in a place where the enemy can see it, post it to the Internet, gives it to a reporter, That individual has indirectly aided the enemy. Now that statute doesn't even require that the information be classified, be sensitive, be intelligence. It really prohibits any kind of interaction with the enemy. It's essentially equivalent to a treason charge. So this charge, I think, without any allegation or proof that someone in Manning's position intended to aid the enemy, I think the charge was unconstitutional. I think had he been convicted, it would have been reversed on appeal. I think the judge avoided that outcome by acquitting Manning, but she could have done an even better thing by not letting the government proceed to trial on that charge.
And she did let that proceed earlier in July when that was raised by the prosecution.
Yeah, she did. And remember, this is the first time in the history of this provision that the government has accused someone of aiding the enemy without also accusing the person of intending to aid the enemy. And if this theory had been allowed to stand, if Manning had been convicted, it would criminalize really any Pentagon spokesperson who speaks in a room with CNN cameras or Al Jazeera cameras there, because, of course, the enemy can watch that broadcast. As I said, The statute doesn't require that the information be classified. It's about preventing you from communicating with the enemy. And so it is a good thing that Manning was acquitted of this charge. I'm sure we'll talk about the other charges.
Sure.
On which he was convicted in a moment.
Well, and speaking of spokesperson, let me get former State Department spokesperson P.J. Crowley back in on our conversation. Do you think the government overcharged when they charged him with aiding the enemy?
I agree with Ben that it was an unnecessary step to take. Although I think the judge in the end did reject the prosecution's logic that merely putting classified or sensitive information on the Internet in and of itself constitutes aiding the enemy. Obviously, had that charge stood, it would have had a significant chilling effect in terms of the relationship between, you know, government spokespeople, government officials, their conversations with journalists and the ability of journalists to report on government activity and hold government to account. So I agree it was a startling logic for the government to pursue. I don't think that it was necessarily as far-reaching as Ben just hinted at the State Department spokesman. I was periodically charged with, you know, communicating in ways that not only would inform the American people, but also send a stern message to America's adversaries. I don't think that, you know, the Manning case or a potential verdict would have interfered with that responsibility.
But do you think, P.J. Crowley, that by charging Manning with aiding the enemy, that the government made him a more sympathetic character?
Well, I've always thought that the Manning case had broader implications beyond just what happened in the investigation and ultimately in the courtroom. My concern 2 years ago when I criticized the Pentagon for its treatment of Bradley Manning was, in fact, my fear was they would undercut what is otherwise a very important and necessary, you know, prosecution. This case unfolded in a military justice system. It has a slightly different intent than a civilian justice system. You know, in the civilian justice, you remove somebody from the community because they pose a ongoing threat to the community. In the military justice system, it's primarily intended to reinforce good order and discipline. Bradley Manning violated his oath of office by sending a massive amount of documentation, you know, to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. He was sent to Iraq to defend the national interest, not to define the national interest. And I think that, you know, while obviously we're in the sentencing phase, right, and we can talk about, you know, what's an adequate level of punishment to send that message to the ranks that if you compromise classified information, there will be consequences. You know, but certainly I think it was an important case and a necessary prosecution. I strongly suspect Ben will disagree with that.
And I do want to.
I'll disagree in this way.
Go ahead, Ben.
Again, was it a necessary trial? After Manning agreed to plead guilty, there was no real factual dispute as to whether he had leaked the documents. And in fact, he accepted criminal responsibility for that and offered a guilty plea that could have carried a sentence of up to 20 years. My view is that the government proceeded to trial here either because they thought 20 years was an insufficient penalty for what Manning did, which is extreme in and of itself, or more likely precisely because they wanted to establish the precedent that treats leaks to the press as equivalent to aiding the enemy. It's a good thing that they failed in that latter attempt, but I really think that this whole 8-week trial could have been avoided had the government accepted the plea, and then we could talk about what's the proper punishment for what Manning did.
What do you think, P.J. Crowley?
And Marty, I actually agree completely with what Ben just said. I thought that the government should have accepted the plea bargain. I do think that 20 years is an adequate level of punishment, send a strong signal, you know, without having it perceived both within this country and around the world as being judicial excess.
Well, let me go back to you, Ben, because the question I was going to ask you, because Bradley Manning did plead guilty to and certainly admitted to the fact that he released all this information to WikiLeaks and to some of these news organizations. What do you think is the appropriate, I guess, punishment, if I can use that word, punishment for that crime?
Yeah, well, let's take one step backwards here. And there may be some who advocate for the position that any Army private gets to decide for himself what is secret and what is public without facing any consequences for that decision. That's certainly not my position. What I do think, though, is that the law needs to take into account what kinds of information was leaked. Was it valuable to the public? Did it spur important public debates? Was it some information that never should have been secret in the first place? Can the government show that there was real harm and not just speculative harm? And that's one of the things that's being talked about right now. And that those factors have to be brought to bear in considering what kind of offense was committed and how serious that offense was. Right now, the espionage laws under which Manning was prosecuted, under which Edward Snowden would be prosecuted, don't even really have room for us to consider the extraordinary public debates that have been generated by the leaks. Look at the Snowden case. Look at the hearings that are taking place in Congress. Look at the national security officials who have been exposed as having lied under oath. Look at the lawsuits that have been filed challenging programs. It's hard to deny that these leaks were extremely valuable, whatever else they might be, but the law is blind to all of that. It's essentially a strict liability offense if you leak information and you have a confidential position. And so that is why, you know, I worry about using these espionage laws to prosecute leakers to the press in the public interest, and why I think we shouldn't be talking about in either the Manning or the Snowden case sentences that run into decades, but really, you know, much more humane punishments that take into account the value of what they did and the unpersuasiveness of the government's claims of harm.
Well, P.J. Crowley, picking up on what Ben Weisner just said, and it's interesting, both Manning and Snowden talk about one of the reasons for the release of all this information was that they wanted the public to know, and they wanted to spark a conversation. What's your response to that?
Well, I think these debates are useful. I think it's very important for the government to be more forthcoming and more transparent in helping people understand at an appropriate level, you know, what government is doing on their behalf to protect them, to secure American interests, and where that difficult line exists between security and privacy. You know, we're 12 years into this challenge, and we still haven't really, you know, defined that. And maybe it's a standard that you know shifts as we understand, you know, the threats to us, you know, better. I mean, in my lifetime, obviously Daniel Ellsberg comes to mind as someone who fits the definition of a whistleblower. But people forget that, you know, before he brought the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, he went to Capitol Hill. He went to members of the executive branch. He said, "You've got to read this and adjust our policy accordingly." Only as a last resort did he go to the New York Times, and I think appropriately so. In the case of Bradley Manning, and in particular Edward Snowden, you know, their first options were WikiLeaks and The Guardian, not their last option. I wish that Edward Snowden, rather than buying a ticket to Hong Kong for a meeting with Glenn Greenwald, you know, bought a ticket to Washington and walked into you know, someone like Ron Wyden, a senator from Oregon, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and said, "Hey, you know, your oversight is not working well." You know, and then Wyden could use that perspective, you know, as he has in the aftermath of Snowden's revelations, you know, to generate a much deeper, broader, and meaningful debate about, you know, government activities on our behalf.
Do you agree with that, Ben?
Can we talk about that first?
We can talk about that. Go ahead.
I think if you had been looking at Ron Wyden over the last couple of years before the Snowden revelations, his hair was on fire. It wasn't that he didn't know what Edward Snowden shared with The Guardian, thus with the public, but that because of his position on the Senate Intelligence Committee, he believed that he was not permitted to share that information with the public and start that debate. You know, had there been an effective way to bring this information to Congress and start this debate without providing it to the press, undoubtedly Snowden or others in his position would have done that. That wasn't the issue. Mm. The problem was that those existing channels, the existing oversight mechanisms, had failed. We had intelligence committees that were getting secret briefings, and the rest of the Congress didn't even know how the government was using the Patriot Act and other provisions. We had a secret court that was issuing opinions after one-sided proceedings, and now you've seen judges from that court, former judges, come forward and say that the system is broken. So I don't think that it is quite correct to say that Edward Snowden could have generated the historic debate that's going on right now by going through recognized channels.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And we are talking both, I guess, we're both talking about Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden as well, but it's hard not to connect these two cases. Ben Wisner, ACLU lawyer, P.J. Crowley, professor at the George Washington University. He served as Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs and State Department spokesman for then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, actually resigned from his post because of the Pentagon's treatment of Bradley Manning. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. PJ, I want to go back to something you said, talking about whistleblowers and talking about Bradley Manning. You describe him as a window shopper, not a whistleblower. And I'm curious what you mean by that.
Well, obviously what separates Bradley Manning from any other leak experience that we've had is the scale and scope of what he provided to WikiLeaks. I mean, normally a leaker has a handful of documents, it's about one issue, and it works its way through the system at a particular speed. But in the case of Manning, it was 700,000 documents. It wasn't just about the war in which Bradley Manning was serving. It was about, in essence, every aspect of U.S. foreign policy. The documents touched on every relationship that the United States has with any other country around the world. if Ravi Manning, as a perceived whistleblower, was saying that all elements of U.S. foreign policy are somehow flawed, one, I think he's wrong, and two, I challenge how a private first class on his first overseas tour has the perspective to make that kind of judgment. Interestingly, in his court statement in February, he revealed the first document that he provided to Julian Assange involved an obscure dispute called ICESave. The parties of that dispute were Iceland, Great Britain, and the Netherlands. The United States was not even a party to the dispute. Ravi Manning, reading one document, decided that U.S. policy towards Iceland was unfair. You know, that's a judgment made by the Secretary of the Treasury or the President of the United States. I don't know what background that Ravi Manning had in international finance to make a judgment that somehow the United States' position with respect to ICES was wrong. So I think the very scope and scale of what Ravi Manning did, that, you know, had he stuck with the what Julian Assange called the collateral murder video, the Apache attack helicopter video, had he stuck with that, I think we could have a reasonable debate about his status as a whistleblower. But when all of a sudden now you're revealing documents about Libya, France, Great Britain, Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, Zimbabwe, what have you, at the end of the day, he had no idea what he was providing to WikiLeaks. And that is, to me, the sharpest contrast between Ravi Manning and, say, Daniel Ellsberg, who had an expertise in the issue that he was concerned about. He knew that document upside up one wall and down the other. And so, you know, I think Daniel Ellsberg can genuinely be called a whistleblower because he had the expertise and the judgment and the knowledge about what he was concerned about. Ravi Manning, at the end of the day, had only a vague understanding of the documents that he was providing to Julian Assange.
And Ben, about a minute before our break here, but do you think people put in danger because of the releases of all this information by Ravi Manning to WikiLeaks?
Well, look, I only know what has been reported in the public. The former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, testified or spoke some years ago that he wasn't aware of any evidence that anybody had been harmed or killed as a result of these disclosures. But that's going to play out right now in the sentencing phase of the Manning trial. I think if the government had very persuasive evidence, they would put it before the public right now because it bolsters their case. But I do think that while that kind of information may not have been relevant at the guilt stage, although it should have been. It's very, very relevant now at the sentencing stage. And now is the time to take into account not only the public value of many of the documents that Manning released, which exposed wrongdoing in some cases and candidly right-doing in other cases, but also now is the time for the government to really make its case. If they think that these disclosures were harmful, they should prove it with evidence and not just allege it from the press podium.
And that's Ben Wisner. He's the director of the ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project, joining us along with P.J. Crowley, who is a professor at the George Washington University. And we're talking about the Ravi Manning case, the Ravi Manning verdict, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Rider University proudly supports WHYY. Rider invites listeners to learn about how its executive MBA program can help professionals leverage their business experience into greater leadership roles in their organizations. There is an executive MBA information session on Saturday, August 10th in Princeton, New Jersey. Registration is online at rider.edu or by phone at 609-896-5036. Rider University, preparing tomorrow's business leaders.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we don't exactly do good radio. We do the radio we can get away with.
All right. This is great. The show's already off the rails. We haven't even started it yet.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz that never goes where it's supposed to. Saturdays at 4 on WHYY.
Is someone who prepares a lethal injection for a death row inmate the same as an executioner?
Where are the ingredients coming from? Who is compounding the drug?
Georgia law is protecting pharmacists being challenged, and an execution is delayed while the whole question of secrecy is examined. A capital case next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Just to recap, a bit more than 3 years after he was arrested for leaking hundreds of thousands of pages of classified military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks and a number of news organizations, Bradley Manning was found guilty this week of 20 charges, including espionage, acquitted of the most serious charge, that aiding the enemy. The judge is now hearing witnesses and will decide on sentencing in the next few weeks. Earlier this year, Bradley Manning admitted to sending information to WikiLeaks and pled guilty to a number of charges. His case generated a great deal of attention and some controversy as well, in part because of his treatment in the military prison. And we are talking with P.J. Crowley and Ben Weisner, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ben, we've done whole shows about one of the things that was revealed in the release to WikiLeaks, and this is this Apache helicopter that killed 12 citizens, including several journalists. This was Baghdad back in 2007. I have looked at it several times. It's gruesome. It's hard to watch. It's also sort of confusing to figure out whether a crime was committed or wasn't committed. I'd just be curious about what you make of that particular release, and that's something that P.J. Crowley mentioned earlier in the hour.
Well, it's an extraordinary experience to watch that.
Yeah.
And I think you actually touched on something very important, which is that it's not at all clear under the rules that have governed U.S. combat operations whether a crime was committed or not. And that in itself is extremely important because this is a window into what war looks like. It's something that I think was quite valuable for the American people to see and for the world to see, whether or not you think, as many do, that a war crime was clearly committed there. And it's certainly one of the releases that Bradley Manning made to WikiLeaks that I think is, you know, an unquestionably valuable one. It's so difficult for reporters to operate in war zones now. It's not like the Vietnam War where they really fanned out across the country. Most of the reporting comes from embedded units and is subject to censorship. And so this was really an unvarnished view of how hideous war can be. Yeah. And I think that Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks certainly did the world a service by presenting it.
P.J. Crowley, let me ask you about something you did. This was back in March of 2011. You resigned from the U.S. State Department as their spokesperson, and you called Manning's treatment, quote, ridiculous and counterproductive and stupid. Were you talking about his treatment at the Quantico Brig?
I was talking about his treatment at the Quantico Brig because it didn't seem to me that the military had an understanding of the lens through which the Bradley Manning investigation, WikiLeaks, and the ultimate trial, you know, was being viewed. And obviously, the fact that the prosecution pursued the aid in the enemy charge was a continuation of that failure to understand the broader context of the case. Ultimately, I think it was the judge that understood the broader context better than many of the other players. In our system of justice, you're innocent until proven guilty. Bradley Manning, whether it was defined as solitary confinement, was in fact in solitary confinement. He was stripped of his clothing at night for I think a false fear of suicide watch, and he was becoming a far more sympathetic figure than I thought was warranted. And ultimately, I thought that treatment was undermining the credibility of a very important, you know, prosecution. Marty, if I could, I want to go back to something
sure.
Ben said before the break, which was the issue of damage. I think that Bob Gates is right that at a strategic level, you can't say that there was damage. You know, the war in Iraq is over. The war in Afghanistan is being wound down. By and large, our international relations are governed by interests, not personalities. There were stresses and strains on a country-by-country basis, and some of those strains still exist. The one area where there is damage, is to the lives of individuals who have talked to American diplomats around the world to help us understand what is going on in a country or around the world. Activists were intimidated, jailed. You know, some of the people who were mentioned in these cables have been killed. I can't sit here and say was it because of the WikiLeaks cables or was it because of what they were doing in their country that, you know, that brought them to our attention and also to the perhaps the autocratic government that was monitoring their activities. But there was damage done. But as Ben said, this is part of the assessment that's going on now. I don't think that Bradley Manning deserved a life sentence. I don't think he deserves what would be perceived as almost a de facto life sentence. I think 20 years is an appropriate sentence to send a strong message to the troops about protecting the national interest and classified information. So I don't want to see Bradley Manning end up, you know, being seen as a martyr. I want him to be seen as a naive soldier who committed a crime.
Let me see what Sean from Horsham has to say. And Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you for taking my phone call.
You're welcome.
I kind of fall on the issue that what Manning did was beneficial towards the United States. He did go through proper channels beforehand. He went to the New York Times and a couple other media outlets before he went to WikiLeaks right away. And it's also that another good instance is what Jeremy Scahill wrote about in Dirty Wars, about the CIA funding proxy wars in the Horn of Africa. He got most of that information from Manning's leaks. So, I mean, it's not that I think a lot of the stuff he did leak out is beneficial to the United States.
Well, Sean, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I should say Jeremy Scahill was on Radio Times. He also went to these countries to see for himself what was going on. But do you think, Ben, Sean has a point?
Well, he certainly has a point that a lot of the information that leaked out, even if it didn't show illegality or wrongdoing, was enormously interesting and useful and really did shine a fascinating light on U.S. foreign policy around the world. And a lot of it did show U.S. support for regimes that are, you know, anything but democratic in their relationship to their own people. Let me also just respond briefly to what PJ said and agree with him in this sense. You know, Manning's treatment in the brig, the isolation, the harsh conditions, and I would add to that a long sentence, may well deter you know, many other soldiers from doing what he did. But if that harsh treatment and the perception that the justice system is not treating him fairly deters 999, it might inspire one. And it might tell that one, the law won't treat you fairly. You're better off getting on a plane and going to a country, even going to a Hong Kong or even going to a Russia, because this isn't a legal system that you can engage with. This is not a legal system that is going to take a nuanced look at the value of the information, at the real harm that it's caused. It's only going to look at whether it was classified by someone else. That's the only consideration. So I do think that there's another way in which a long sentence for Manning would be counterproductive, because it only takes, you know, one or two out of the many thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who have access to this information to make the decision to release information.
PJ, do you think, though, that the government, including the military, the Pentagon, do you think they overclassify information that by all standards shouldn't be classified, but it is, and therefore sort of out of the reach of the public and the press?
Well, as a broad statement, yes, we have too many secrets. But then again, you know, when you look at what Bradley Manning released, you know, for example, a significant percentage of the documents were raw intelligence information collected by soldiers on the battlefield. You know, they encountered this villager said X, and they're reporting it up the chain to see if it gets connected to some other information. Should raw intelligence reports be classified? I think the answer is yes, because we don't, you know, this is a perception from one corner of one village. It may or may not be true. But I think people would generally think that intelligence information for a period of time should be classified. If you're talking about diplomatic conversations that go on between an ambassador and a president, a prime minister, a king, in diplomacy, is there a a need for confidentiality so that the United States and the leader of another country can be candid with each other about what's happening and what needs to be done? I think the answer is yes. You know, now you're well on your way to appropriate classification of a fairly significant percentage of what Bradley Manning released. I think the other piece of this is not necessarily whether we have too many secrets. A lot of diplomatic activity now is occurring on classified networks. At my State Department desk, I had an unclassified computer and network. I had a classified computer and network. The moment I sent an email and five people responded to that email, it generated a large number of classified documents. I think another consideration here is not necessarily whether at any particular time we have too many secrets, but we declassify information and perspective far more rapidly than we would otherwise do. You know, in security circles, you have something called the terror line. You know, much of the information contained in classified documents is not particularly startling. Generally, it reinforces our understanding of issues of significance. It's usually the source and method. Was this a piece of technology? Was this a human source? How did we obtain this information? That's what's generally the most sensitive. And we've got to find a way. And obviously, in the public debate that has followed Snowden's revelations, we're finding a way of having a meaningful conversation without compromising classified information. We've got to do a better job of doing that and having a more robust debate at an unclassified level, which should satisfy the need for the public to understand what government is doing, either support or reject what the government's doing, but give the kind of public guidance that's necessary for a democratic government to pursue its interests in concert with our values.
Well, Ben, just picking up on what PJ just said there, do you think that the time is right and the culture is right that we can have some kind of national conversation about many secret things the government does without damaging national security?
I hope so. I do think that one of the reasons why we've relied on leaks to the press and intrepid investigative journalists is that our traditional oversight mechanisms have really failed. And I say that as someone who for the last dozen years has been trying to litigate the legality of a lot of these programs and been turned out of court based on claims of secrecy and the state secrets privilege. Every claim that we brought to a U.S. court on behalf of someone who was tortured by the CIA or the U.S. military was dismissed without any adjudication on the ground of state secrets or standing or immunity. Every lawsuit that the ACLU brought to challenge NSA surveillance before the Snowden revelations was dismissed, on the sort of catch-22 that we didn't have proof that our plaintiffs had actually been surveilled, but we couldn't get that proof because it was a state secret. Mm-hmm. And so when you have what are supposed to be oversight mechanisms, not doing their job, not operating as real checks and balances, then we rely on journalism, and journalists rely on leakers. And I do hope that in particular the Snowden revelations, which have, I think in a real bipartisan way, been seen as enormously valuable to this national debate. Even President Obama said that he welcomes the debate that the revelations have generated. I think now would be a good time for us to try to address the systemic reasons why many people, including me, think that these unauthorized leaks are so necessary.
Let me squeeze one more caller on. We've got Barry from Mount Airy. Barry, we're almost out of time. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'd like to mention that I'm a Navy veteran, and under the UCMJ, you're not innocent till proven guilty. You're guilty till proven innocent. And I think that's a very distinct difference in the way the military justice works as opposed to civilian justice. And I don't hear that being talked about.
Fair enough. Let me give PJ. Can you respond to that, PJ?
That's for sure. I think that as a nation of the laws, it is the opposite. Although obviously the military has greater leverage of someone over someone in uniform than someone in civilian life. I just want to echo what Ben said. I do think that investigative journalism is important. But you've got to distinguish between WikiLeaks, which I don't necessarily believe is a journalistic organization, although its activities mirror journalistic organizations. I think Julian Assange is an activist, not a journalist. But in my dealings with the traditional media who were reporting on what was released by WikiLeaks, there was an earnest concern about reporting these fairly and accurately, but at the same time, recognizing that lives were at stake, and they gave us within government the opportunity to say, make a case that about why we shouldn't mention this name or this program or this intelligence activity, and if you can prove that a vital national interest is in jeopardy or that lives are at stake, you know, we'll find a way to report around that. And that's where I think that traditional journalists who understand the context within which these revelations take place, that's the kind of important and responsible journalism that's necessary to find the right balance here.
Well, we could go on, but the clock is telling me we are out of time. P.J. Crowley, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
A pleasure, Marty.
And Ben Weiser, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, and also thanks to P.J. Crowley for a civil and interesting discussion.
Indeed. And Ben Weiser is the director of the ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project. P.J. Crowley, currently professor of the George Washington University. You probably remember him. He was a spokesperson for then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, resigned from his post after criticizing the Pentagon's treatment of Bradley Manning. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archives. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.